This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Thank you all for wearing masks. It means I get to do this without one, which makes my life so much easier. I've done these with a mask on, and it's not pleasant. So today I'm going to be giving a talk mostly drawn from the book Palo Alto, which maybe some of you have checked out, heard me talk about on some podcast or whatever. I don't want to just repeat that stuff that you've already heard because, you know, you paid for admission. This is Socialism 2023. You know, you can get that on that podcast or whatever. So I wrote a more specific talk about Silicon Valley eugenics and its relationship to the Nazi Third Reich, which is a question, it's something I've been getting like a lot of questions about. And it's something I touch on in the book, but it's not a real focus. So this is sort of like a B-side, I was saying. So I'm really excited to share that with all of you. I do have a slideshow that makes this talk way better. As you can see, there is no AV capacity for such a slideshow. However, we all have phones, right? So we can do, thanks to the wonders of Silicon Valley, we can do a distributed slideshow. So if you pull up your phones, if you follow me on Twitter, I just tweeted the link out, you can just pull it up on there. Or you can go to bit.ly/Palo Alto System, all lowercase, all one word, and that should pull you up on a slideshow that says, quote, "Enemies to Lovers, the Long Relationship Between Nazism and Silicon Valley," which is the title of the talk that we're doing today. Is that working for people? All right, so the URL, if you don't follow me on Twitter, you should just follow me on Twitter. It'll always be Twitter to me. But for anyone who doesn't have that, the link is bit.ly/Palo Alto System, and that's all one word, no caps. And that should come up just fine. Oh, thanks whoever just followed me on Twitter, thanks. Ray, if you're in the room, Ray, I appreciate it. All right, and when I see people, it's hard because I shouldn't wait for people's heads to pop up because you're going to be looking down at the slideshow, which is totally fine. So I'm going to get started unless someone says to stop that they're still loading. If you need help, nip to your neighbor because it seems like people are figuring it out. Sweet. Okay, so if you see on the first slide is a collage of different Silicon Valley eugenicist headlines from the past couple months. I did not have to look hard for these, let me tell you. There's been a major point of social discussion because the leaders of Silicon Valley have, for whatever reason, in the past year or so, couple years, I think since the beginning of COVID, felt more at peace with saying what they really believe. And part of that has been some sort of shocking statements about eugenics, human biodiversity, cultivating better humans, all of these things that we associate with not just 100 years ago, but with specifically the politics of Hitler and the Nazi Reich. And people are surprised to be seeing this coming out of Silicon Valley, which is supposed to be, you know, the opposite of these antiquated parochial divisions. We're in the future and we're all going to be post-human anyway. Why would they be interested in such things? However, there's a Yeah. Ultimately dismantle it. That's true. We're going to get there. So as I said, a lot of this is from my book, which you can check out in the bookstore. It's available. If you have it at home and want your copy signed but didn't bring it, I've got these cool official book plates from the publisher. So you can just bug me after. Just remember to do that. Okay. So on our first slides, we've got a picture of a little horse track. And what that horse track is was the origin of Palo Alto as a town. Because before Palo Alto was the site of Leland Stanford Junior University, the junior's important, it was the site of what was called the Palo Alto Stock Farm. And the Palo Alto Stock Farm was the most advanced eugenic and training project in the world for trotting horses at the end of the 19th century. And you might be familiar with this story from the photos of Edward Muybridge, which are themselves the first moving pictures ever created. You may have saw it in the movie Nope referenced. This was happening in Palo Alto, and these pictures were just one small aspect of this scientific project that was called the Palo Alto System. And the Palo Alto System was about designing and creating a new kind of horse, a horse that was better than any horse that had ever been created in the world. And we think of this, it seems kind of silly now, and it's the story's told as a story about like this guy who liked gambling or whatever. But horses at the time were the engines of society. Whether they're dragging military equipment, agricultural equipment, they're doing streetcars through the streets of cities, they're doing boats through canals, engines, right? Horses were engines. And Leland Stanford, who was the oligarch at the head of the railroad, decides, I'm going to make a better horse. I'm a capitalist. I can do it. And all the people who worked on horses said, this guy's crazy. Don't listen to him. And yet he's able to pull it off. And the way he's able to pull it off is he looks to Germany. And so the name of this track that they created in Palo Alto was called the Kindergarten Track. And the idea of the Palo Alto system was they would start training horses as young as possible to determine which the strongest horses were so that they could put all of their resources into backing only the strongest horses from their youth. And this was antithetical to horse training at the time, which held if you raced your young horses too hard, you'd break their limbs and you'd spoil them, which they did do. But because Leland Stanford was a capitalist and really a new kind of capitalist, he could afford the scale to waste horses. But the reason it was called the Kindergarten Track is because Germany had come to a very similar conclusion about their state and in terms of what the state's resources were going to be used for. And the reason we still have kindergarten as the title for early childhood education is because the Germans were the ones who decide in the 1870s, children are an asset to the state. And that we are the judgments of the market are going to be too harsh on our state of Germany unless we start training our children from births as assets to this state. And I've got this great quote from Nietzsche in there, who's at the time a like lowly professor in Baden, and is complaining, Baden-Baden, and is complaining like, oh God, education these days is all about like what you can be for the state. The Germans are just like making into this whole thing. It's terrible. But it was the Californians who were really looking to the Germans for this eugenic example when he starts this school. And so Leland Stanford Junior University begins as a school after the death of the Stanford couple's only child, Leland Stanford Junior. And Leland Stanford Senior and his wife Jane decides, we're going to take these resources that we were going to funnel into our child and we're going to spread them on the settler class of California, that the children of California will be our children. And they had to go get a new president for this new school, and they found a guy named David Starr Jordan, who was the president of Indiana University. And Indiana University was a major agricultural school, and so a lot of what they were working on was itself also eugenics. And David Starr Jordan himself was a, like, nationally and internationally renowned eugenicist. And he takes a group of eugenicist types from Indiana University and moves them to Palo Alto, where he sets up this sort of new capital for eugenic research in the United States, and especially in the West. But David Starr Jordan's this really interesting guy because he is such a eugenicist, so believing in the order of races, and like very, very specific believing in the order of races that like the Europeans don't count anymore because they're too decadent, you know. And he has like very, very specific ideas about everyone in the world. But one of the outcomes of this thinking is that he was an anti-imperialist because he doesn't want, for example, the Philippines or Puerto Rico within the United States polity. He doesn't want to have to deal with that, which makes him a outspoken voice for anti-imperialism, as well as an outspoken voice against war. And so he becomes a global pacifist, and his argument for pacifism in the pre-World War I period is that war is dysgenic. And he has this great quote that I want to read from his book, The Blood of the Nation, which again, yeah, sounds like a Nazi-style eugenicist tract, right? But it's important to draw these distinctions because he was an anti-militarist. And so what he argues was, there was once a time when the struggles of armies resulted in a survival of the fittest, when the race was indeed to the swift and the battle to the strong. The invention of villainous gunpowder has changed all of this. Except the kind of warfare called guerrilla, the quality of the individual has ceased to be much of a factor. The clown can shoot down the hero and doesn't have to look the hero in the face as he does so. And so he, in the run-up to World War I, in this era of what they called super-imperialism, he was a very, very active player in trying to get, you know, the world powers to get along, because war was going to set us all back, especially the United States and the West, which was the eugenic hope for the world, because that was also one of his conclusions, was that, like, he had these sort of just-so stories about how everyone in the world is just, like, a little bit off, except for the Anglo-Saxon man of the West, which was the future of humanity. And so he takes this book and he actually sends it to the Emperor of Germany through a friend of his who's within the military hierarchy, this book saying, like, don't do war, war is dysgenic, saying, like, you Germans, you seem like you guys would be really interested in this, you know, 1911. And he gets this letter back from his, you know, buddy saying, yeah, you know, like, everyone thinks we're going to, like, start a war all of a sudden, but, like, really, it's just because we're in the middle of all these countries and we need a strong navy to just, like, basically just protect us. And, like, really, we don't believe in war. And this is, like, 1910 or whatever, 1911. At the same time, he also has a personal relationship with the Emperor of Japan, with Emperor Mutsuhito, who he, like, goes and visits him and has a one-on-one reception and is given, like, an order of the empire. He makes a giant study of fish in Japan because he's an ichthyologist by tradition, or by his profession. And he actually, like, spends a lot of time with Japan and has a very personal relationship with the ruling class of both of these countries, as you can see. And so this is sort of the theory of super-imperialism that they were holding on to at the time, was that, like, there's not going to be war between these countries because we all know each other. Like, we're buddies. If I can talk to if I'm one step away from the Emperor of Germany, if I'm right there with the Emperor of Japan, like, there's no way we're going to end up in a war with each other, which was the line. And for a while, that seemed true of America, who stayed out of World War I at the beginning. But as part of the America's role in the world before World War I starts, they actually send one of the Stanford eugenicist types to Germany as a liaison to the German high command. And his name was Vernon Kellogg. And he's another bionomist from Indiana who goes to Stanford, very, very strong believer in eugenics. And so he goes to Germany thinking, like, okay, I know what these guys are about. I know this work. They know this work. Like, let's chat. Let's see what they think. He is horrified by what he finds out in Germany, which is that they really do believe in advancement of the race through militarism, and that war is the only way to establish that you are the superior race. And he comes home and he writes this long, long article for the Atlantic Monthly that is then published as a book, like, right after the U.S. enters the war. And see if I can read this. He says, I went into northern France and Belgium to act as a neutral, and I did act as a neutral all the time I was there. If I learned there anything of military value which could be used against the Germans, I shall not reveal it. It's kind of funny, right? Like, you would never say that today, but the idea of honor was very strange. But I came out no neutral. Also, I went in an ardent hater of war, and I came out a more ardent one. I have seen the side of the horror and waste and outrage of war, which is worse than the side revealed on the battlefield. How I hope for the end of all war. But I have come out believing that that cannot come until any people which has dedicated itself to the philosophy and practice of war as a means of human advancement to put into a position of impotence to indulge its belief at will, which is a convoluted way of saying, like, if we don't stop them, no one's going to stop them. My conviction is that Germany is such a people, and that it can be put into this position only by the result of war itself. It knows no other argument and will accept no other decision. And so the California eugenicists who hold pacifism like above all and believe that war is more dysgenic than anything else, through their direct contact with the German high command, determine like, all right, fuck it, like we're gonna have to fight a war. Like these people are crazy. And so the Stanford eugenicists jump into the war, right? They're like, how do we use our expertise to fight this war? And so if you see a slide that has a guy in round glasses and a bunch of soldiers sitting on the ground raising their hands. So that's Lewis Terman. He's the inventor of the Stanford-Binet IQ test, otherwise known as the IQ test, period. And one of the first usages of the IQ test, it first had to be developed for a mass audience, was called the Army Alpha Test, and then the Army Beta Test, which was for soldiers who weren't literate. So the Army Alpha was for literate soldiers. And so the picture you see there is soldiers sitting on the ground. They didn't have time to build the desks that they needed, you know, this was wartime. Sitting on the ground holding their pencils in the air, waiting for the go to start their IQ test. And if you look in the next slide, you can see some of their faces zoomed in. Yeah, like, that's what it looks like to be the first guy to ever get an IQ test, right? And the idea of the Army Alpha tests wasn't as much about combat effectiveness as combating the dysgenic nature of war. So if you were the Stanford eugenicists and you're worried that you're about to send the best of the best genes you have, into the trenches to die, you want to find some alternative to that. And a good alternative to that is giving people the IQ tests. So you know, all right, you're the A students. We're going to keep you back here in our ROTC, back at the college or whatever, or in some bunker somewhere. The B students, maybe we'll pull them back a little bit. Like, C students, perfect. Like, take this gun. You're in the trenches. F students, maybe we want to find something else for you to do that doesn't involve, like, holding a gun. Because who knows what's going to happen. You're probably not going to be the most, like, combat effective. And so right away, you see the use of this Stanford West Coast eugenics becoming a military asset to the United States, like, immediately. Which is important in World War I. You know, we win World War I partly thanks to the scientific research that was being done to prepare the military to use all the resources of the state, right? We follow the German model to a certain degree, and we end up winning that conflict or being part of the winning side of that conflict. But where it really comes in handy is World War II. So in the next slide, you see two like really mid-century looking white guys. The one on the left happens to be wearing, we've got maybe a slide up here if you can see the general look, or maybe look on somebody else in your row. The guy on the left happens to be wearing the exact same round glasses as Lewis Terman, the inventor of the IQ test, and that's because his name is Frederick Terman, one of the first takers of the IQ test. And the whole idea about losing the best minds of your society on the trenches didn't really hit me till I figured out that Frederick Terman turned 18 just in the same month, I think it was, that the draft age got lowered to 18. And so Lewis Terman, who's giving the IQ tests, he knows that his son is a genius, like, first of all, because he's his son, and as we all know, genius is like directly communicated through bloodlines. But also because he had tested him, and Frederick Terman was very much a genius. And so this was a personal thing for Terman, for Lewis Terman, the inventor of the IQ test. But he successfully is able to protect his son during the war, so that by the time World War II is ready to kick off, Frederick Terman is one of the best assets that the United States has in terms of fighting this battle. Because he goes off to what was called the Rad Lab at MIT and helps develop radar. And that's ultimately one of the really, really crucial decisive facts in the war is avionics, the electronics for airplanes that were developed not just out of the Stanford milieu, but by the eugenics subjects of the First World War era. Frederick Terman was a big one, and he ends up being the head of the engineering department at Stanford and going on to being the provost and really like making Stanford into the post-war university it becomes. But the other guy next to him is named William Shockley. Is another test of the genius experiments. He actually did not score high enough to be considered a genius, which is something that he, you know, always took very personally, even when he later wins the Nobel Prize in physics for developing the semiconductor. Still hurts his feelings that he wasn't a genius as a like 4-year-old or whatever. But he's another product of this eugenic milieu in Stanford. And during the war, he plays a similar, if like less lauded, role than Terman. And he basically invents operations research. And so he's like going around the war solving like weird math problems. Like, we keep dropping these bombs on the subs, but the bombs don't blow up any subs. Like, what's wrong with our bombs? And he's got a team of actuaries using pencils. And they figure out, like, oh, the fuse is timed wrong, and if we just change the fuse like this, and it totally this changes submarine warfare for the entire war. And he's awarded the top civilian honor during the war, as is Terman. And so World War II becomes this, like, perfect example of West Coast eugenics against Nazi eugenics, right? Like, these people are not just have similar ideas about how genes are passed and race and such things like that. And don't get me wrong, like, Lewis Terman was very, very, very much a racist. But they're not Nazis. They're very much not Nazis. And in fact, they defeat the Nazis in combat. They are as responsible for the defeat of the Nazis in combat as anyone else in America, basically, at that point. At the same time, the Nazis themselves are sort of thinking about California as a goal, as like the, I include a bit from Pete Cockle's book, The American West and the Nazi East, that like for the Nazis, they said, go east, young man, talking about like taking over the Soviet Union and killing all the people there and like setting up farms, that like that was going to be their homesteading in the same way that the Americans pulled it off with Manifest Destiny. However, in my book, a point I try to make very clear is that California is not the end point of some westward sweep of Manifest Destiny. It's really an overseas colony for the United States in the mid-19th century. And so, like, unsurprisingly, this Nazi metaphor is not actually very good, right? It's not, like, super accurate. So the idea that, like, oh, the Nazis just, like, took what they were going to do from the United States, like, not really. About as much as they referenced, like, Attila the Hun during their invasion of China in the early 20th century, which is why we still call the Germans the Huns or whatever, is because they invoked that past military glory as well. Something the Nazis are fond of, but then not necessarily very accurate at, which doesn't let America off the hook at all. So when the war ends, you've got these guys, Shockley and Terman, who are now dealing with a new threat. And everyone, I think, at the Socialist Conference knows what the new threat to America after World War II was, which was the Soviet Union. And so now you go from fighting the Soviets, or fighting the Nazis, allied with the Soviets, to trying to outmaneuver the Soviets, particularly through nuclear weapons. And so you see the in one of the slides, you've got a picture of the Rad Lab on the left where Terman was working during the war. On the right, you've got this patent application from 1948 from William Shockley, who was working at Bell Labs at the time. And this is a really, really interesting, this is before he helps develop the transisting semiconductor, or semiconducting transistor, at Bell Labs. But already he's thinking about missile targeting. Because this is the most important, Shockley knows that this is the most important thing for the end of the war, for the post-war situation, is the missile war. And so his patent was, imagine how do you do missile targeting without electronics when semiconductors haven't been invented yet? His idea was you take a transparency of the place you want to bomb and you put that in your missile, and then you've got a camera that's looking out and comparing the light that it's receiving to the transparency that you've got of the place that you want to bomb. And the idea is when the site of the place matches the transparency, that it fulfills this circuit that then dive bombs the bomb that targets it. This is what the semiconductor is. Like, this is then the integrated circuit semiconductor that becomes Silicon Valley, that's made out of silicon, is this targeting element. Shockley does not end up developing it because he's such an asshole that literally, like, I'm not even like doing revisionism here. He's just like literally such a psycho, like so obsessed with IQ and competition that even though in this post-war period when he says, I'm going to create this, a silicon semiconductor, I'm gonna go build a team, the best minds in the world, sort of like Oppenheimer or whatever, if you've seen that. Like, I'm gonna go around even to Europe, I'm gonna recruit the best physicists, and they're all gonna wanna work for me because I'm a Nobel Prize winner. And he was right. And he assembles this just like amazing crew that really spokes to the Roosevelt era as well, because they're white guys, all of them, but from all over with all sorts of different backgrounds. So whether you're like Robert Noyce and you're a preacher's son from Iowa, or you're Kleiner and you're a like Jewish refugee, he's bringing together this sort of FDR's shuffled deck of white men in the post-war period to build the chip that's going to go into the nuclear missiles, that's going to secure the American position in this post-war era. But he doesn't pull it off again, because all these people that he pulls together are like, damn, we don't want to work for you. You are such an asshole. And you keep making us take all these tests and like compete against each other for some reason. And like, we're all elite level physicists, and why are we taking like IQ tests? And it's because he was totally obsessed. So eight of those guys, who are known in history as the Traitorous Eight, leave Shockley and start their own semiconductor company called Fairchild, which invents the silicon semiconductor. The chips that we have now come out of that Fairchild company. You can see that first chip is the next slide. And that first generation goes entirely into the Minuteman I nuclear missiles. And you'll hear stories about like, oh, from 61 to 63, like NASA was the biggest user of bullshit. Like, if you go 1 year on either end, it's all nuclear missiles. Like, it was a technology developed for nuclear missiles. And the sort of NASA story is how Silicon Valley likes to tell the story about itself in the post-war era. But it was about establishing American hegemony in the Cold War world. They did this in part by developing the Silicon Valley industry that we know today, including some of the companies that we still know today. So one of them is Hewlett-Packard, which you may have heard of, founded by two Stanford students named Dave Packard and Bill Hewlett. And they made predominantly electronics testing instruments. And so when you think of something like nuclear missiles, you think of like, oh, you got to build a big missile and there's a missile factory in Southern California or whatever, which is partly true. But actually, the real production by value has to do with the electronics that are going into the missile. And those electronics use up a bunch of electronic testing instruments. And so you don't think of like Hewlett-Packard as building nuclear missiles, because they weren't building nuclear missiles, but they were absolutely crucial to the development of those kind of technologies and America's technological edge, period, during this era. But one of the things that America wins during this period is the ability to offshore its production. And that starts happening much earlier and in different places than people imagine that it was. People, I think, tend to think of this as like an 80s, 90s story about outsourcing production, but it starts in the 50s and 60s. And it starts particularly in Germany and Japan, which have been destroyed by US bombs built by the same California milieu created with the testing instruments of Hewlett-Packard. And so Hewlett-Packard is actually the first company that goes and starts setting up factories in Germany, in Böblingen in the 50s, and then in Japan in the early 60s. And so you can see this picture of Dave Packard eating sushi in the early 60s with two, like, I guess, welcoming women sort of looking very, very disconcerted next to him. It's a very strange picture. This was a conquered people, right? This is America had beaten Germany and Japan, and we acted like it. And part of acting like it was using those spaces to build up America's next industry, which was electronics. I'm going to skip ahead a little bit because I want to make sure we have some time for questions. So what you see is an op-ed from Science Magazine, or for the journal, major journal in science, and the headline is, "Shockley was a racist and eugenicist." That's it. That is an editorial published in the peer-reviewed Science Magazine that they link to whenever William Shockley's name is mentioned in Science Magazine now and into the future. They have committed to linking to this editorial every time his name is brought up. Because not only was he a Nobel Prize-winning inventor of the transistor, Shockley was a racist and a eugenicist. In fact, a notable racist and eugenicist. And so after he loses his company, you know, after Shockley Semiconductor shuts down, he gets a comfortable chair at, of course, Stanford University without any really particular responsibilities. It's like, you're one of our best geniuses here. Have an endowed chair. What he ended up doing with that endowed chair is creating the largest, probably, distribution point for Nazi propaganda in America during the period. And when I say Nazi propaganda, I'm not exaggerating. I'm not talking about like the California eugenicists. I'm not talking about David Starr Jordan. I mean neo-Nazism into the 70s, 80s, 90s. And I think if you're over 50 or 60 and you know Shockley's name and you're not in physics, that's where you know his name from. Because he put a lot of work spreading these ideas, including behind the name of the Nobel Prize. So he put his Nobel Prize to work spreading these eugenicist ideas, literally like writing letters to the who's who in America, to everyone saying like, look, we figured out genetics and actually here's what it is. It's what we always thought the whole time, and now we have proof. He was not a geneticist. He doesn't know this stuff. He was making it up. He was cracked in the head. But Stanford supports him to a certain degree, and he's able to convince a lot of people then that this was an idea whose time had come for the reactionary right, whose the concessions of the post-war era were too great for them, and they had to sort of scrape back this supremacist position. And this genetic research, especially with the imprimatur of a Nobel Prize winner, was extremely attractive. And Shockley is able to convince this guy named Arthur Jensen, who's a researcher at Stanford at the time, researching education. And he's able to, Jensen comes in as a social determinist, and Shockley is able to convince him that, like, look, in particular, talking about black people, if black people can't score as high as white people after all this time, it's got to be in the genes. It's got to be in the genes. And Jensen becomes convinced, and he publishes this article in the Harvard Review of Education. It's the longest article in the history of the Harvard Review of Education. It's like the first 120 pages of the issue or whatever, in which he argues that compensatory education has failed. The idea that through affirmative action and through increased spending on education, racial minorities would be raised to the same educational status as white people was an experiment that has failed, that's incorrect, and that we have to acknowledge this. And despite him not being a geneticist either, you know, he's an education scholar, he has no basis for this, it's becomes very, very, very popular. Extremely, if you scroll down, you can see picture of him playing the flute, and it says, "A scientist's variations on a disturbing racial theme." And this is a big, like, Life magazine article. I thought the music thing is a very weird combination. But Jensen is the one who grabs this baton from Shockley and becomes the one of the national spokesmen, the most respected national spokesman of white supremacy in the country at the time. Shockley has been, if you scroll up a little bit, you can see Shockley being burned in effigy. Shockley was very more and more controversial because he said really wacky shit. But Jensen seemed to be more respectable. And in fact, the Jensen argument makes it very quickly to the White House, to the Nixon White House, where they're discussing social programs and the idea of affirmative action. And someone says, "What about Jensen?" And Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who's Nixon's Secretary for Urban Affairs, has to give the answer because, of course, there are no black people in the room. And what he says, I think the quote from Moynihan is really important. "Someone asked, 'What about Jensen?' And the president asked me if I knew anything about it, and I briefed the cabinet. Who Jensen is, what he said, the essentials, that it was merely a hypothesis, that in fact we have no direct knowledge of a genetic basis of intelligence, only inferential knowledge, and nobody knows what a smart gene looks like, that Dr. Jensen is a thoroughly respectable man, and that he is in no sense a racist, but that it is merely a hypothesis." Now, of course, he was very much a racist, but I think it's revelatory that that's the best argument that liberals could manage. You know, the liberal Secretary for Urban Affairs, the author of the Moynihan Report, right? This is the best argument he could manage for social construction at this point, was like, well, we're really not sure if that's true. And if that's the best he can give you, then like maybe you listen to the Nobel Prize winner who's confirming your priors about like actually white people are the best. We figured it out. And so Jensen's argument becomes even more nationally popular when it's featured in a book called The Bell Curve by Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray, which is a bestseller, you know, the most popular instance of scientific racism of the late 20th century. Extremely influential book. Still an extremely influential book. And Jensen was his main source, especially for black-white disparities. In fact, Herrnstein sort of like likes to think of himself as the third musketeer to Shockley and Jensen. Not really, but like he likes to flatter himself. But the Bell Curve was very, very successful and very influential. And in the last slide, you can see an op-ed from the Stanford paper from the mid-90s, just a couple years after Shockley's died, the case against affirmative action, and it uses the exact same Jensen argument of like compensatory education has failed. And it's by two guys named Peter Thiel and David Sachs, who you may know from now, the full circle. And they have this great quote where they said, "None of this is to deny that there are some people in America who are racist, and that there are some features of American life that are legacies of a much more racist past. But racism is not everywhere, and there is very little at a place like Stanford." Thank you all.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.